this is Katie Day and welcome to Creating Ripples, the program that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Melody Cheel. Melody has a degree in psychology, an MSc in applied positive psychology, a diploma in psychotherapy, and is an NLP master trainer. Her psychological approaches to coaching course is accredited by the Association for Coaching. She has taught positive psychology as a visiting lecturer at the University of East London. She regularly speaks at national conferences and has presented her dissertation research, NLP and Self-Esteem, at an international research conference. Her work was published in an academic journal as a result. She is also the co-author of the popular book, The Model Presenter. Her new book, Becoming Happy, combines NLP and positive psychology with her wildlife photography hobby. She loves to inspire others to step into their best version of themselves and to realise you are brilliant. Thank you, Melody. That's a lovely mantra for people to imbibe about themselves, to have about themselves. You are brilliant. How many times do you come across people who don't believe that?
Well, unfortunately, it's very common. And I think very much in the way we live in Western society, people are raised to not feel good about themselves. Mm. And some of that comes from within the family and within the culture. And of course, in the modern world, very much there's an influence from social media, from films, magazines, etc., where people are taking on perhaps unrealistic images of what it means to be a human being.
That's interesting. So what do you mean by unrealistic expectations of what it is to be a human being? What does that look like for you?
Well, I think on the one level, if we just go with appearance, for instance, most of the images that we're seeing, particularly of celebrities, are not as they were created.
So that's a very nice way to put it.
Very much enhanced. The shame of it is the people themselves are probably, well, not probably, they're absolutely fine as they are, but there's a pressure on them to present a particular look. And we see this obviously when the tabloids catch them on the way to the shops where they look normal. But of course, many people look at the images that have been altered and think that that is actually how things are. Mm-hmm. I mean, one in particular that stands out for me is a common practice of changing the length of people's leg bones in imagery, so their legs look longer. Good so grief. They're actually not even physically correct.
Good grief. So Photoshop has a lot to answer for, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Wow. It has some good sides, but also some bad sides. But then on the other hand, of course, people tend to present, generally speaking, an edited version of themselves out on social media as well. So So there'll be the people that it appears like they have everything, their life works brilliantly. And then for people who are struggling, they may look at stories like that and then feel disheartened. Mm. And they're just not hearing the whole story. I think that's often the case. So they're misinterpreting the way life is, perhaps, in that way.
We're very good at wearing masks, aren't we? And creating illusions as human beings. It's something we've mastered.
Absolutely, all through history. I mean, you've only got to think about how Carl Jung spoke about masks as well and archetypes and how... Yeah, we live very symbolically as well in that sense that we're trying to fit some kind of mould of some sort. So, you know, I think this was going on even before social media. I think to some degree it's just been magnified by the readiness and the easy accessibility of all this stuff.
When it comes to the physical portrayal of us, do you notice a gender difference in that? Is there more pressure on women to conform to a supposed ideal, or do you think it's equal across both genders?
I think that's changing. I think it was more towards the female side of things, but I think it's actually starting to creep in with the guys as well now. Mm. So interestingly enough, I get more women attending my workshops than men. So I may also not even be seeing the tip of the iceberg with that. So I'm not sure. I think possibly with younger men, there's more pressure. Some men of different generations may have grown up with different attitudes, so they may be less affected by it. But I think things are changing, not necessarily in a great way for that.
How do we get back to accepting ourselves as we are? Or do you think we have ever accepted ourselves as we really are?
Well, it's an interesting one. I draw on wildlife photography a lot for illustrating my books and my Facebook page. And one of the things that you see about with animals is very few animals seem to have any self-esteem issues. So they accept themselves as they are. They're pretty happy. If they're happy, they're happy. If they're not happy, they're not happy. But if they're not happy, it's for a reason.
Right.
So something has happened or their environment isn't good for them or something, some such. Perhaps the issue for us has been this whole idea where we have got a mindset now that allows us to think about the future in quite an extreme way. I'm sure some animals will have a small element of future thinking, but that's more like, when's my next meal? Whereas for human beings, we will fantasize about what might happen when we speak to somebody, and sometimes that will be a positive thing, and for some people they may actually go through a whole story to themselves about what might happen if they ask a question, or if they give someone some feedback, or maybe say no to somebody. And they'll live out the entire experience in their imagination. I doubt very much that dogs do that, for instance.
When you're saying that, I think, oh, God. I can think of so many times I've done that. Less so now, but I can remember when I was younger and I had less confidence.
Absolutely.
I agonised over stuff. And of course, I was completely missing everything that I was there to hear, because my conscious mind was telling me all of these stories and all of these fantasies, none of which ever came true, interestingly.
Absolutely. I mean, I was exactly the same myself, particularly before I started my personal development journey. And I can remember the other side of that is when we rehashed the past as well. And where I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking about a conversation I'd had with someone where I thought perhaps they were criticizing me or putting me down. And of course, some of the time, that was in my imagination as well, that they had maybe made a comment that was a throwaway line as far as they were concerned. But for me, it had big impact. And I think this is the other side of being a human being, that we will filter information as we receive it to make it fit what we know about the world. So if we're living in an experience of low self-esteem, the risk is that we will interpret everything in a way that's unhealthy. And actually, there's a story I share very regularly with my students about myself, because I grew up with a very negative self-image about myself. I believed myself to be ugly, so I was that extreme in the words that I used. And it really stayed with me for a long time. And the point where I knew that I'd put this one behind me was a day when I'd had an electrician come round to do just a small piece of work. And he'd finished and I was writing his check, and he picked up one of my marketing leaflets, turned it over, and there was a picture of me on the back. And his comment was, "That picture doesn't do you any favours, does it, love?"
Oh, now, okay.
Now, my reaction was to laugh. Now, some years before that, before I'd changed how I felt about things, I would have taken that as criticism. I would have taken it as him calling me ugly. But actually, if you consider what he really said, he was saying that I was better looking in real life than the picture.
Yeah.
But that's not how
that's not what you heard.
I would have heard it differently. And what I in fact did was I looked at the picture and thought, well, he's absolutely right. It's a dreadful picture of me. And I immediately changed my marketing materials as a result.
Gosh.
So I got a different picture. So it was really useful feedback for me. And quite frankly, for him, I doubt he even remembered the comment 5 minutes after he'd walked out the front door.
Yeah.
But for me, if I hadn't changed how I felt, I might well have been thinking about that for months and months on end.
Mm.
And I think the beauty of this for me is, one of the reasons I'm drawn to this work is that I've kind of been there, so I know what it feels like to have those feelings about oneself. And having gone through the other side, it's a lot easier for me now to empathise with somebody else and actually be able to say, and things can change. We have the ability to change how we view the world, how we interact with the world. And as a result of that, we end up with a happier life.
A lot of people have a lot invested in staying where they are, though. How do you help them push through that?
Well, interestingly enough, in the NLP world, there is an aspect of that that I think is sometimes missing from some of the other approaches. And it's the idea of recognizing that behind every behavior and belief, there's a positive intention why we created that belief or why we continue with that behavior.
Okay.
Sometimes it's safety, sometimes it's protection, sometimes it's just the least worst option, and we maybe don't know anything else. But that's why we keep doing stuff. So if we can help people to shift that aspect of it so they can still maintain that positive intention. So if it's about staying safe, it's staying safe in a healthier way. So for instance, people may have things about keeping other people away from them because they have a fear of perhaps being hurt. Mm-hmm. But if people can then discover that there are ways they can actually make different evaluations, different judgments, where they can recognize actually they can keep themselves safe in other ways, and that maybe they already do that and they haven't realized that the old belief was actually even out of date. Mm-hmm. So what we're actually doing in that sense, or what I'm doing when I help someone with that, is I'm helping them to make that connection on a deep level. And it's more than just talking about it. It's making it a change at the unconscious level rather than just the conscious level. So it's a change that goes all the way through them.
And is it sustainable, or will the old thought come back? Because it's a bit like, isn't it, changing, say, use the analogy of sailing. If your autopilot is set in one direction and you move the wheel, whatever it's called on a boat, because you see something over there that looks quite nice, but you forget to change the autopilot. You take your attention off and the boat will readjust to the original path. So how do you get a new thought to be the new autopilot so you don't keep veering back to the old way of thinking and being?
Well, it's a lovely metaphor, and I like that metaphor, actually. I use similar ones, actually. One of the things I often talk about is nobody would expect to go to the gym once and be fit.
Oh, really? You mean I can't just join? I actually have to turn up? Rats.
I'm really sorry if that's bursting a bubble. Personal development is really a journey, and there are times when we can have a paradigm shift where something is so profound that we just get it at such a deep level that we never go back. Mm-hmm. That certainly happened for me in my personal development journey. I was very fortunate to be on a workshop where over the period of really just 3 or 4 days, it's almost as if I just woke up and suddenly realized I had value as a human being, which I genuinely didn't know the day before.
Gosh.
So that paradigm shift has never gone back. That one has been complete. However, I probably focused on my personal development for 2 years in great detail, and I continue to still do stuff for myself now. So 25 years on, I still attend workshops, I still have one-to-ones, I still do things around my own personal development, I journal. So I do all kinds of things to check my direction. So if I was in that sailing boat, I'd be checking my direction. And I think that is actually an important thing to say, because I think sometimes in the personal development world, we have people who do what I call overclaiming, where they're almost talking like something out of the old Wild West, the medicine man, the snake oil man saying, drink my potion and you will be forever healed. Okay. And it just seems a little unrealistic because we're so complicated as people. And by the same token, we can make changes quite fast if we have, if we're in the right place ourselves. And I think that's really important. Mm. The person has to be ready. Mm. It's no good somebody being forced to go along to get help, either one-to-one or on a workshop. They have to want it. And for me, for instance, I had the phrase running through my head of, there must be more to life than this. And that's the kind of comment I hear quite regularly from people. And I think when people get to that stage, they've got a lot of motivation to change. So the motivation can be there. My husband, on the other hand, he didn't actually have that depth of happiness in his life. He'd had a pretty happy life, and he was driven by curiosity.
Oh, interesting.
So for him, he still made changes, and he's still taking this on. He's my business partner as well, so we do all this work together. His background's in psychology too, and he's also an NLP master trainer. So we work together, but we've come inside in sort of parallel lives in that sense, into how we got to where we are. So some people make small incremental changes as they go along. Other people make paradigm shifts. And I think there is a case for, we need to be conscious of what's happening in our lives, recognizing if we need more help.
So what you're saying is really, you don't have to be somebody in trouble in order to benefit from this work, because you said your husband came into it from the position of curiosity as opposed to perceived, in inverted commas, need.
Yes.
The one thing that really struck me, that I just want to kind of briefly go back to, is the medicine man or woman, you know, come to me and drink my potion. As well, what I see is a big danger about people who do that, of which there are many, is that they are raising unrealistic expectations in the other person, and they are also not empowering that person to take ownership of their own journey. They're allowing them, in a way, to stay in the victim role, to say, okay, I don't have to do anything because you will cure me. You know, it's like abusing people who abuse their bodies with whatever it is, nicotine, alcohol, drugs, bad food, no exercise, turn up to the doctor and say, fix me, when they've taken no ownership of their own health. And then, do you believe that until we take ownership of our journey, nothing will change?
I do, actually. And in fact, I was running hypnotherapy training just last week, and one of the messages I gave to my students was that they need to stay humble and recognize that if somebody changes, that we haven't changed them. That all we've done is we've facilitated them changing themselves.
Yeah, it's so really important.
So absolutely. So it's a little bit like going into a dark cave and giving somebody a torch.
Yeah, they can switch it on, or they can not switch it on. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And it really is about facilitating change rather than taking ownership for it. Because I think there's a real risk that we can become famous in our own lifetime. where we think we're doing these things where we're changing everybody and we're changing the world. And while I'm proud of the work that I do, I also think it's really important that we give credit to people for making their own changes and empowering them. And so they actually feel inspired to own their own life. And that, for me, is probably the most exciting thing. When I see one of my students just step forward and they've just gone into a place of being totally who they really were meant to be all along, and who they were, of course, underneath it all, they just hadn't recognised it.
It must be huge job satisfaction when you see people have those aha moments and kind of almost physically see the layers falling away from them. Because people do become physically lighter, don't they, when they have those kind of aha moments. So, you know, because the whole physiology will change in front of your very eyes.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, it's an amazing thing when I see that with people I work with. It's an incredible thing to witness somebody's transformation literally in front of your very eyes.
Yes, and it is amazing. And sometimes it's even seeing it, first of all, where maybe they haven't recognised it themselves, first of all, and actually maybe noticing the awareness of it creeping over them.
Yeah.
So for some people, it can be it's kind of very slow, and for other people, there'll just be that moment where something just dropped. You know, it's like a penny's dropped, and they've just really got it. And that's very rewarding as well.
How do you help people manage that when they have come out of, say, a workshop environment or the environment of working with you, whether one-to-one or in a group, and they have to go back to the real world where everybody else around them hasn't been to your workshop and may have a lot invested in keeping that person where they were rather than encouraging them to be who they now are? How do you help people manage that process and that transition?
Well, what you're talking about is actually very, very important. And so there's two sides to that story, really. The first is that we always do talk to people about what we call in NLP ecology. So it's the idea of recognizing that there's a knock-on effect to change. And And this is particularly important, for instance, in people's personal relationships. So if somebody's married and they come and their husband or wife hasn't done the training, it could actually destabilise the relationship.
Mm.
So it's really important for us to help people, first of all, recognise that they need to be gentle with their partner. They need to actually handle how they change things for themselves in a way that nourishes the relationship. So, and of course, the first question needs to be, how do they feel about their relationship as well? Because personally, I left a marriage when I first started my personal development journey. It was actually an abusive marriage, and it was, for me, a freeing. But I see lots of people who come on the workshops who actually, they really love their partner, they want to carry on with their partner, and so for them it's important that they recognise that they have to have some sensitivity with their partner about how they make the changes in their life. The other side of that is that, and this for me is key, we have always offered our students ongoing support pretty much as long as they want it. I've got students that trained with me 15, 16 years ago who I still speak to regularly. We do ongoing CPD, I run supervision groups. We have what's called a practice group where people come along just to plug in. And we use the social media as well. So we have a Facebook page as well, so people can keep up with what's going on. And I think that's really important, because sometimes people go on a training course and get a qualification like NLP practitioner, and then they're set loose in the world to get on with things. And actually, it's almost like, I don't know if you had the same experience as me, when I passed my driving test, I learned how to drive afterwards.
It's funny you say that. My driving instructor actually said to me, I'm teaching you to pass your test, then you'll learn to drive. Yeah.
Exactly. So the same is true really with the practitioner, that people need to really have the support after they've actually started using the work out there, either for themselves, for others, or even in their day job.
Yeah, it's like putting on a new coat, isn't it? It has to kind of settle, and it feels odd. It kind of feels like a pressure when you put on a new item of clothing. You're physically aware of it, and then when you've worn it a few times, you're no longer consciously aware of the feeling of it because it's become a part of you. And it's, I guess it's the same thing.
It is, and it's that journey from conscious competence to unconscious competence.
Yeah.
We go on automatic pilot and we can just do things automatically at that stage.
I mean, NLP is a fascinating thing. This is not my opinion. I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Yes, please.
Is it not simply jargon to describe something that has always been there and that we've always used, that somebody's just packaged it in a way that is easy marketing and easy to sell? That's the first question. And also, there is a dark side to it when it's abused. What's your view of how that can be managed?
So let me take that in several layers there. The first thing is, on one level, you're right, it is all stuff that's always been there, but from a number of reasons. And I say this about all psychology, by the way.
Okay.
Because all psychology is about working with people.
Right.
And it's just different ways of studying the same thing.
Okay.
So, for instance, I'm trained in a number of psychometrics. All of the psychometrics measure the same thing. They're just different labels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just different ways of looking at it. Now, NLP itself, a lot of people don't actually fully appreciate where it came from.
Oh, okay.
And really, NLP was what's called a modelling project, where in the early days, Richard Bandler, John Grinder and Frank Puchalek were studying three world-class therapists and trying to work out how they did it.
Ah.
So the first two they studied were Virginia Satir, who was a very well-known American family therapist, and Fritz Perls, who is the person who is responsible for founding the work around Gestalt therapy.
Ah.
And what they did was they observed them in many ways. They had Virginia, they had direct contact with. I think Fritz Perls was more from videos and recordings. And John Grinder himself was a linguistics expert. So they were analysing what they were doing, and that's where they came up with one of the NLP language patterns, which is the meta model. And that was about how these people were talking to their clients in such a way that change was happening. Mm. And they thought at that point, we've got the secret to therapy. We know how it works.
Okay.
And there was a chap called Gregory Bateson, who was also very influential, who then said to Richard, John and Frank, well, actually, you've only got half the story. Let me introduce you to somebody else. And they were introduced to Milton Erickson, who was a hypnotherapist who was, again, an amazing kind of hypnotherapist. He worked for 60 years every day.
Wow.
He was pretty much.
Wow.
So he was working right up to when he died at around the age of 80, around 1980. Wow. And he seemed to be linguistically doing the exact opposite, but having equally good results. Because the meta model is about really helping people gain clarity, whereas the and then find their own solutions. The Milton model, which was Milton Erickson's model, is about getting people to go deep inside themselves and find their own answers. So clearly, all of that work had been going on before NLP was even a phrase. So it was about bringing all those ideas together and packaging them. And I think, you know, the argument of the repackaging could be leveled, for instance, at positive psychology, equally so.
Mm.
Because a lot of the stuff in positive psychology is drawn from, in particular NLP, interestingly enough, but also things like solution-focused therapy, various other resilience therapies, and all the other things, great things that have been out there for years and years and years. So I think rebranding's happening in psychology all the time.
Right.
So I think that's true. But what they really did with this was they actually put things together in a way that hadn't been so easy to teach people before. Because both Fritz Perls, Virginia Satir, and Milton Erickson were naturally brilliant.
Okay.
If you just ask them, how did you do that, they didn't know. Because they just did it. It's a bit like an athlete who's fantastic and who just does stuff. Now, clearly, if they get a really good coach, their coach can actually improve them. However, the natural talent stuff just happens, and the people don't know how they're doing it. What the early NLP pioneers were doing was examining how people were doing things and including how were they thinking about it. And that was the extra piece as well, about mapping out, well, we've got this, and there's a lot of research that's only just been published in the last 10 years about the power of internal imagery, which up until about 10 years ago, there wasn't any research on it.
Mm.
And one of the things NLP has been doing is using internal imagery and how we talk to ourselves, how we have internal feelings as part of the change process. Because if you take something like post-traumatic stress, for instance, people have flashbacks and relive events in Technicolor. Mm-hmm. And really, it's intruding in their lives in a major way. And currently in the States, there's some research going on with a guy called Rick Gray. And he's working with war veterans using NLP techniques, and they're getting more progress in the first two-hour session than some people were getting in 2 years of traditional therapy.
Well, there's a lot over here, isn't there, using versions of NLP or incorporating it into other methods, work with war veterans on PTSD.
Mm. Absolutely, and some of the work over here is actually connected to the work in the States as well. So Lisa Wake's doing some of that over here, for instance, and she's connected to the same group that Rick Gray's in. In the States, they're just starting to get actually quite good funding to do the work. Because that's the one thing that's been missing from NLP up until now is good grounded research, partly because people haven't been doing it. Now, back to the dark side for a moment that you mentioned there. The way to think about it is it's a tool. And any tool can be used or misused.
Mm.
And I think that's true of anything in psychology. For me personally, I call my approach humanistic. And the way I work with people is all about ethics. My students have to sign ethics forms. That's actually part of their journey. And I think it's really interesting. People are attracted to the trainer whose values marry up with their own. And I've yet to have a person put themselves forward to join our school who I felt uncomfortable with in that way.
Interesting.
Because they've realised, and we're very clear about it, I think. So we don't really do sales focus and that kind of thing. We're really focused on personal development, human potential, helping people be the best versions of themselves and working ethically.
It's a shame because these people, of which there are very few, but their impact is very big. Because they will give something where the essence of it is for good and and promote a public perception that is the complete opposite to that. And that's it. So they may be very small in number, but the impact they have on NLP generally is huge. And you know, these people, I mean, I can think of two, they both happen to be British, and they both happen to be men, of how, and they are in the public eye, you know, they're famous. But from where I sit, I believe that they have abused NLP, and they're doing it to be manipulative and for entertainment. But their impact is huge, and they fill auditoriums.
Yeah, and that's so true. I mean, the good news is 4 years ago, there was a group set up called the NLP Leadership Summit, of which my husband and myself are founder group members. There were about, I think, 20 of us in the first meeting. And it's world leaders in NLP across the world joining together. And we call ourselves a collaboration rather than anything else. And we are, there's people from countries all over the world. And we had our first 3-day conference in January in Alicante. And there were people from South America, Australia, United States, UK, all across Europe. And we as a group are dedicated to changing some of those things that we're unhappy about. So we are together raising profiles, raising standards. In the UK, we're really lucky. We do have an organisation called the ANLP, which is a truly independent professional body for NLP. And so that's also a step forward, because that helps us to raise professionalism and people can have their work externally accredited. So I'm also on the accreditation panel for that, for instance. So I look at other people's courses to make sure that they're meeting those standards and hopefully exceeding them. So there's quite a movement afoot, really, to address some of these things, because many of us are uncomfortable with some of those things that are going on that are giving that, really, that image. Because I think entertainment's fine. And it is actually okay for people to be entertained, and there needs to be an ethical boundary around it. There needs to be some stuff in there. And I think, you know, there are a few entertainers I can think of who sometimes do things, even on the TV, that are clearly unethical and bring us into disrepute. But then again, that happens with psychology generally as well. So there's been a lot of popular psychology TV shows. I can think of one in particular where they recreated the Stanford experiment, which is the prisoners and wardens experiment, and they did that on TV.
I can remember that.
Well, I'm surprised they didn't have anyone have a psychotic break on that, because it was really badly managed, and it had to be shut down in the university when it was done. So that gives you the clue that it wasn't actually a very ethical study. And of course, at least things done in university have ethics panels, have ethics committees, who will actually step in if something's getting out of hand. Things end up on the TV. Doesn't seem to be anybody accountable for that kind of stuff. And so I think that's an issue really for psychology as a whole, that we need to find a way of protecting the public as much as anything else from unethical work.
But is it part of the public, and of course of which we are a part, because we're not separate from the public,
no,
in inverted commas, we are part of it. But is it also the responsibility of the public to turn their back on this, because these things are only produced because there is an appetite for them? So if there was no appetite for them, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? So, you know, what was it that somebody in televisual land experimented and realized it got really good rating figures and created the need within the public? And so it's grown and grown and grown. But of course, we do have a choice. You know, I never buy a newspaper, because only bad news sells, and I'm not going to give my hard-earned money to promote bad news. I find out everything that I need to know, but I don't do it via a newspaper. So we have a choice of whether we read, watch, or listen to this stuff, but an awful lot of people get sucked into it, and almost it becomes a voyeuristic addiction. So we, the public, are actually feeding these people, aren't they? You know, these people are millionaires, but they're only millionaires because the public watches them, goes to their arena dues, buys their books, buys their CDs, whatever, whatever. So we are also part of the problem.
I think you've got a really good point there. And as you were speaking, I was just thinking back to the days when the Romans threw people to the lions and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of not, it's not new.
It's not new, is it? No. It really isn't.
It really is. It's a shame, isn't it? But and I guess I'm an optimist. I'm a natural optimist, I think. And I think there's something going on out there where there is a growing number of people wanting to live the ethical life. Whether that's to do with psychology or to do with other things. You know, people are more concerned about the environment than they've ever been before. Yeah. Whether it's going to take another 50, 100, 200 years for that evolution for it to happen, I don't know. And of course, countries that are impoverished haven't got, you know, if we think about Maslow's needs, they haven't got time to think about that stuff yet. They're still busy trying to just survive.
It is a first world problem, really, all this, isn't it?
Yeah, at the moment, yeah, we've got time to contemplate our navels.
Yeah.
You know, there are people out there that don't. There are people that don't have enough to eat. There are people who could get shot, you know, could get a house fire, you know, a forest fire or whatever it might be. I mean, I'm going off on a tangent here, but I guess it's let's change the world as well, you know, and it seems such a shame that we are all in such wealth. Even the poorest of the poor in our society is wealthier than some people living in some parts of the world.
Absolutely. I often wonder if, you know, therapy, counselling, psychotherapy, coaching, and I am one, NLP, I often wonder if this is the indulgence of the West. And actually, we all need to get over ourselves. Because, you know, if you go to the less developed countries, as you rightly say, they haven't got time to be worrying about what happened to them when they were six. You know, they just don't have time for this. You know, they have to go out and find food for today. They're much better at living in the present. And I think this whole thing of fantasizing, as you said at the beginning of the interview, about what may happen if I ask this question, if I do this, is really a luxury of the developed world. And it's perhaps a negative aspect of the developed world is that we have the luxury of time to become really self-focused. And actually, maybe we just need to stop it and just get on with living.
Well, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Maybe there is something to that. And yet, I think what we're doing, if we think going back to the Maslow idea again, it's as we get our needs met at different levels, we're actually in a position to contemplate things, and maybe part of contemplating ourselves is also then contemplating the life of others and how we might impact on others. Yeah. And I think for me, for instance, the definition of healthy self-esteem is somebody who values themselves but also values others. And some of the definitions miss that bit out because for me, that's absolutely key. Because what's the point of valuing self if we don't recognize that on one level, we're no more valuable than the next person. And also no less valuable.
Yeah.
So it's about having that self-awareness. And I guess you've got to start with yourself. Somebody, you know, a person needs to get to a stage of saying, yeah, actually, I do have value. I do have worth. I've got something to contribute to the world. And then they're in a better position to recognise other people do. I've got a couple of young women who've actually done two workshops with me this year already. That I'm practitioner in hypnosis, and they're going on to do master practitioner. And some of the things they've been saying to me over the last few weeks have been really exciting to hear. One in particular had talked about how she recognised now that often when she was finding other people irritating and annoying in the past, it was a self-defence thing. But now she looks at those same people and can actually see what's good about them, and also can see that she was annoying herself.
Interesting.
And that they weren't actually doing anything. Yeah. They were just being themselves.
Yeah.
And that it was one of her own buttons being pushed. Yep. And that button had gone.
Yep.
And she no longer has that experience. And so she's now starting to be more compassionate and caring just in her everyday interactions with people, where perhaps before she was using being judgmental as a way of staying safe. So it was all. That was one of her ways of staying safe. And she's not alone there. I think that's something I've certainly done it myself in the past.
I have too.
I think it's one of the things we do as human beings. If we can make ourselves better than somebody else, we can kind of fool ourselves about feeling okay, when the reality is we are okay. And it doesn't, and actually it's not a comparison anyway.
And it isn't. I mean, it's a really interesting point, because it's what I talk about when I do my training as well, is that if you react negatively to somebody, it's got nothing to do with them and everything to do with you. So if I find myself reacting negatively to somebody, I'll press the pause button and think, okay, that's interesting. What button have they just pressed? And what do I need to go back and look at again and maybe do a bit more healing around? Because I know the person standing next to me will have a completely different reaction to the same person in the same moment. So it's nothing to do with them. But that, again, is going back to that ownership thing, isn't it? Which isn't always easy to do. That is about changing your internal autopilot. And sometimes it's also easier to get sucked along with the crowd, isn't it? Which is why people do buy into the negativity around the world, because we have a fundamental drive within us to be part of a tribe.
Yes.
And to stand out of that tribe and be the maverick is really challenging sometimes for a lot of people. And it's easier to just to go with the flow.
Absolutely. And I think in order to feel part of something, you've got to have something else you're not part of.
Yeah.
So if you're part of a tribe, then there have to be people who are not part of the tribe. And I think, sadly, I wonder whether as a planet we'll unite fully at the point where the aliens really do turn up. Yeah. So we can all unite together at that point, because we've now got somebody coming from another planet. Because we're so busy defining ourselves by our separation at the moment.
We are, hugely, hugely. And we always have been, as you say. You know, you think of the lions and, you know, go back to Roman times. We have always been like that. And it seems to me incredibly sad that we waste so much energy in areas that aren't always positive. And what would the planet be like? What would the human race be like if we stopped doing that and we rechanneled all of that energy into positive actions, positive behaviour, positive thoughts? I wonder what we would look like today. Where would we be?
And I guess all we can do is be the stone that's thrown into the pool ourselves, create the ripples.
Yeah.
And the more people that are creating the ripples, the more chance we have of having a change on a global level.
Absolutely.
And as an optimist, I believe we can do that.
And bless you for bringing in the name of the radio station into your comment there. I can't believe we're already up to 42 minutes. I want to talk about your book, Becoming Happy, combining positive psychology, NLP and wildlife photography. So tell us more about that. That's a fascinating combination.
Yes, it's really a book aimed at anyone who would like to just make some changes for themselves. So it could be anybody really, but it could be someone who maybe hasn't done anything at all up until now. So they're just really ready to make a change. I've been learning wildlife photography from an amazing wildlife photographer called David Plummer.
Yeah.
And he was on the One Show a couple of weeks ago, because he got early onset Parkinson's 7 years ago. And he's just produced a book called 7 Years of Camera Shake. And he's splitting the proceeds of that with a Parkinson's charity. And he's really an absolute master at this. And so I've used my images in my book knowing that I'm a beginner. So I have some really beautiful images. But if I were to put my images next to his, you'd be able to tell the difference.
Okay.
And one of the things I put in the introduction is the reason why I've done that. One is I've just enjoyed doing them. But secondly, it's as a metaphor about how we can be good enough, really, now. So even though I know I can improve my photography, and I will, I'm having a session on Monday photographing owls with him, for instance.
Wow.
He'll give me lots and lots of feedback. I shall learn stuff. My photos will improve. And I can still enjoy the journey. So I've shared some of my pictures to illustrate, including there's a whole group of photographs about with red squirrels, for instance, in the middle, about a day when I went out looking for them. So what I've included in the book is examples from my own life, but also some actual exercises people can do for themselves to help make changes, including things. There's a positive psychology technique, for instance, called positive reminiscing, which is about getting good at remembering the good old days, would be a way of putting it. Now, some people do that naturally, and they tend to be people who are often quite happy. But other people do what I was guilty of in my early days, of raking over the coals over unhappy memories. Yeah. And of course, the memories we activate the most often are the ones that are the strongest. Mm. So if we actively do work with positive reminiscing, we're strengthening our links to our own happy memories. And we can change really how we view our lives by doing that. So, for instance, when I first started personal development, I thought I'd had a 100% unhappy childhood. I've now actively recalled the things that I did enjoy. Many of them were to do with animals, interestingly enough. And now, when I look back at my childhood, although I haven't forgotten the things that happened that were less than positive, they've kind of faded. They've gone a bit black and white, whereas the positive memories have grown in size, become more colourful, become more attractive. So I can remember things now from my childhood fondly, which I couldn't do before. So positive reminiscing is one of the ways you might do that. I've also acknowledged one of my school teachers in the acknowledgements as well, Elizabeth Fletcher, who I've just posted today, actually, her copy of the book, because I'm still in contact with her, because she was the first person who inspired me. So she was the first person when I was about 12 who made me feel as if I had value at that point. She was the first person that made the difference for me. So I've shared a lot of things like that in there. And there's probably, I don't know, a dozen or so different activities scattered through the book for people to do for themselves so they can start their own journey. And I've got a couple of coaches already who've actually bought batches of them off me to give to their clients, which was very gratifying to hear. So a very nice experience from that point of view.
So how can people get hold of your book?
Well, I hope it should be on Amazon very soon, because I'm speaking to a distributor at the moment, but they can get it direct from me at the moment. So if they just email me direct, so I'm guessing you'll give my contact details at some point.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you just put those on there, if people want a copy, they can email me. I will be getting it up on my website in the next couple of weeks, because it is actually really hot off the press. So I've literally just taken delivery of it in the last week or so.
Oh my gosh, so yeah, very new. How exciting, how exciting. So what's the future have you, or do you not know? Do you allow it to evolve organically? Do you set your goals? Do you have a vision of where you want to go?
I do have a vision, but it's a changeable vision. Because I think it's nice to just go with the flow a little bit. Mm-hmm. So we have our own training centre here now, just on the edge of Ashdown Forest in East Sussex. We overlook a beautiful setting, and we've only been here a short while. So I really want to expand into running a lot more personal development things here. I already run all of my accredited training courses in NLP and coaching and hypnotherapy, and it would be nice to maybe do some things that are just about being happy, you know, just chilling out and reconnecting with ourselves. So that's something I'm really looking forward to, and that would be nice to maybe do in a couple of other locations as well. I mean, this summer I'm doing some one-day workshops for the Association for Coaching, for instance, mm-hmm. on positive psychology. I'm doing one in London, one in Sheffield. So there's lots of exciting things out there, and there'll be more. There'll be more, and some of it will be just going out with my camera as well.
So are you going to have another edition of Becoming Happy as your photography improves or changes? Will you be having a second edition with new photos?
There will be some more books with new photos. I've actually got, would you believe, 5 books started at the moment.
Oh, good Lord.
Because I realised that there were several different topics I wanted to address. So I've actually got them started. They'll all be illustrated in the same way. So they'll become a series, really. So I'm doing one at the moment that I'm just trying to remember what I called it now. Something like Bouncing Back. So more about resilience. So, and I'm also doing a book that will be for coaches, really. So applying the coaching techniques that I use as well. So people can people who are already coaches can look at how they might use some of my techniques with their clients.
Fantastic. Well, I can't believe 50 minutes has gone in like 5 minutes. I'm not quite sure. Time seems to change when I do these interviews. It seems to speed up. But thank you so much. It was a wonderful interview. Thank you for your time. It's been brilliant.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
So this has been Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. As women, we are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.